I'm Don Smith. I'm on the Bridge Builder team, and I want to introduce to you this morning Dr. Peter Stanky. Sorry about that. Dr. Stanky is a Lutheran pastor from Austin and a national consultant to congregations. His program, Bridge Builder, is a process to help congregations in times of transition and tension. His workshop today will begin with a presentation called The Congregation as an Emotional System. That will be followed by individual written responses, and I assume everyone received a sheet of questions when you came in. Everybody got those? So after the presentation, everyone will fill those out to turn in, and then we'll take a short break and come back for a session called Tell It to Peter, where everyone will get a chance to say what's on their mind. After his presentation this morning, we are going to take up a collection. There is no money in the budget to pay for these services, and we think they're important services, and we hope that you'll all give generously to help cover the cost of Dr. Stanky's services. Thank you very much.
Good morning. First of all, let me introduce myself. And then a little bit more about the process. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I've served in a parish for 15 years. I also have a background in therapy. I developed a home for emotionally disturbed youth in North Carolina. Also a pastoral counseling center for a Roman Catholic hospital in Chicago. For 14 years, I served as director of clergy care for Lutheran Social Service of the South, and I just did therapy with clergy and members of their family. And in 1996, I received a grant and became a church consultant and developed a program called Healthy Congregations. In fact, I've probably trained over 100 Unitarians in that program, both here in the United States, also in Canada. My wife and I live in, I like to say, bee caves. It sounds like a mysterious place to everybody that doesn't know or anything. My wife teaches at Austin Community College. She's an artist. She teaches design. We have four children, three up in the Northeast. They're all college professors. And we have a son here in Austin that creates internet games. So that's my background. I also like to write, and I've written three books with Alban Institute. If anybody's interested in purchasing, I have some. Happen to have some here with me. One is called Healthy Congregations, and the other is Congregational Leadership in Anxious Times. I studied with a Jewish rabbi named Edwin Friedman, who himself wrote a best-selling book called Generation to Generation, and another book called Leadership in the Age of the Quick Fix, A Failure of Nerve. He was very instrumental in my own development. My therapeutic background was in individual therapy, but when I met Dr. Friedman, he converted me to see things in a systemic way, an organic way. And he also I guess in some ways, helped me get into the work I'm doing now as a consultant, because I look at the system, not as at individuals. And how do people interact and influence each other through each one's behavior? So that's quickly my background, and I'm going to now introduce you to a theory that undergirds the process that we're a part of. And the theory is called Bowen Family Systems Theory. And Mary Bowen was a psychiatrist, worked at the Menninger Clinic, then also went to Washington, D.C., established the Georgetown Family Center. He was one of a number of individuals 30, 40 years ago who were part of the family systems movement. We look at human problems not in terms of inner states or feelings or conditions, but more in terms of how are people influencing and impacting each other in terms of a system. Dr. Edwin Friedman was my mentor, a rabbi, and he had studied with Dr. Bowen for 20 years. So that's just quickly my background. I'm going to introduce you, first of all, to the idea of the emotional system. This was very unique to Dr. Bone. Many family systems theorists had agreement on certain areas, but this made Bowen theory very unique because Dr. Bowen used the word emotional in a very technical way. Emotional, he meant anything in your behavior or mind that is automatic, instinctive, reflexive, mindless, and for the most part defensive, is part of the emotional system. So anything that is instinctive and automatic is part of what he called the emotional system. This would actually include our feelings, which we often equate with emotional, but also includes all kinds of behaviors, which are not thought out, premeditated, but they're very deep-seated, innate. We all participate in them. Now, we also know that emotional systems are very sensitive to anxiety. When anxiety arises in an individual or within a group, behavior is more automatic than thoughtful. Behavior is more instinctual as opposed to intentional. Behavior is more mindless than thought out. And this is just part of who we are as human beings. Because we have been created with an incredible power for self-preservation, for safety, for security. And that comes out of our lower brain. Our lower brain, by the way, there's no thought. This is where comes the emotional aspect of our behavior. It's all instinctive. And there is a part of our emotional brain called the amygdala, A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A. And the amygdala is our fear button. It's our anxiety alarm system. As soon as we sense something in the environment to be a threat to us, the amygdala goes to work. Actually, the amygdala is only interested in two things. Will something harm me, or will something eliminate me? And as soon as there is that interpretation, it can send the signal to what they call the low road or the high road. When it goes to the low road, it's instinctive behavior. When it goes to the high road, it means it goes to the thinking brain, and we may think out whether or not this is really a threat to us or not. Now, what might trigger your amygdala and what might trigger my amygdala could be different. Or it could also be the same. It depends upon our early experiences, because the amygdala is the source of all memory for the first 3 years of life. About the fourth year, the hippocampus becomes that source for memory. But for the first 3 years of life, it's the amygdala. So many of our early memories come from those things that might harm us or eliminate us, but for the long term, it has a lot of survival value. So, I have discovered that there are certain triggers for anxiety in systems, particularly the church system. You have some notoriety as far as I'm concerned, because this is the 200th congregation I have worked with since 1989, in 20 years. 201 is in Oklahoma, and 202 is going to be in California. But anyway, you're the 200th one, so I'll never forget you. I have discovered that there's more than these 13 triggers, because a minister in Iowa called me one day, and he said, "Steinke, you'll remember me. I was the guy at your workshop who told you that our church had 15 of those 13 triggers." Now, what I normally find is that 5 or 6 or 7 of the triggers I'm going to list for you occur serially or simultaneously. And if they do, the congregation should be anxious because it's a trigger of anxiety. Now, sometimes just 1 or 2 could elicit anxiety, but normally there's 5, 6, or 7 of these. The number one trigger is money. Okay? Follow the money trail, you follow the anxiety trail. We don't have enough of it, how will we raise it? How will we proportion it is also a major issue. By the way, I was the keynote speaker for a conference of the large churches of the Unitarian Church in San Diego 6 or 7 years ago. And I happened to sit at lunchtime with a group of people from Shelter Rock Unitarian Church on Long Island. How many of you know about Shelter Rock? Okay, Shelter Rock has a lot of money. Okay, they have over a $200 million endowment. Annually, they receive $20 million from the gas and oil royalties of the North Sea. They own a 54-acre estate on the North Shore of Long Island. 300 members, $5 million annual budget, 12 full-time staff. But they also have their problems. In fact, I remember a lady invited me to do a workshop there, and she said, "What is your fee?" And I told her. And she said, "Could you please double that so the people think you're worth it?" I said, "If you're interested in value, I could do far better than doubling." But their per-member giving is $82 a year. And the treasurer said to me at lunchtime, "You have no idea what it's like to work with a community like this where so little of their own possessions and goods are given and their commitment." But money is a trigger of anxiety. Number two, sex and sexuality. All churches are dealing with these issues and it just gets people crazy. Next, three, in-laws. No, I'm not kidding. But it sounds like a family. Sex, money, in-laws. But the third one is one that also has occurred here. And I hear it across the country, irregardless of the denomination. And it's almost the same phrase. The pastor's leadership style. Now, for some people, that's a euphemism. Or, "I don't like the pastor." Okay. But for a lot of places, it really means we're not sure that the pastor's leadership style is what we need at this moment. Or if this is the style we want. And it's kind of interesting that more churches don't spend time with their ministers on what kind of leadership is necessary here. And what kind of leadership do we really want? It's just kind of amazing. I was in North Carolina in October, and a director of missions for the Baptist Church, who had invited me to come to speak, said that every 5 minutes a Baptist minister resigns. Every 5 minutes. I'm now into my... Well, it's a new year, but last year I did 13 interventions. So far, I already have 5 for this year. And I know that these 5 this year, as well as the 13 last year, involve this issue, pastor's leadership style. It's becoming quite crucial. In fact, the whole issue of governance, how do we govern ourselves, was occasionally an issue with churches that I worked with prior to 3 years ago. But with the 33 churches I've worked with in the last 3 years, that's been an issue everywhere. And I was telling somebody beforehand, I don't know if it's accidental or coincidental or what, but it kind of dates with Katrina. Okay. But this becomes a crucial issue. Who are we? How are we going to organize ourselves? Who sets priorities? Who sets the vision? How are decisions made, etc.? Fourth, I call it grow survival. There are churches that grow and get anxious because we're larger now than we used to be. And when we were 200 members, I knew everybody. Now that we're 600 members, I don't know everybody. And I didn't know where my place is in the organization. I was with a church in Houston that grew from 300 members to 2,700 members in 3.5 years. It's a huge growth. They had purchased 27 acres for a new building. They asked their pastor to leave because they said to the pastor, "You're good for a smaller size church. Those are your skills, but your skills are not for a larger size church." He eventually left, went to a smaller church, is doing well. But he was a good pastor, and it really upset a lot of people that he left. That's when they brought me in. It was kind of interesting because they interviewed the 21 largest, it was a Lutheran church in the United States. What are the traits, characteristics, qualities needed to be a pastor of a 2,700 and if not a 5,000 member church? They gave me the list, and I said, you know, when I read this list, I feel a little queasy. And they said, well, what's wrong with the list? I said, well, I see a word here 8 times, and I don't know what you mean by it. And someone said, well, what is that word? And I said, the word is dynamic. Dynamic, 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 dynamic. What do you mean? Someone will come here and have sex with 8 women. Is this dynamic? Got real quiet. But I had their attention, and I said, you sit here like flypaper for narcissists. Somebody's going to come here and just totally overwhelm you, and you're just going to fall in love with this person. And that's not necessarily the person you need. Okay? Because this person needs you, and it won't be an even game. Well, I got my point across because the chair of the church council said when I left, Reverend Steinke, thank you for your dynamic presentation. Survival is also part of that, and 85% of the congregations in the United States today are at a plateau in membership or in decline. So people are very, very concerned about their continuance, their survival. Next, any harm done to a child or death of a child. I could almost spend an hour with you describing what clergy have told me about the anxiety developed in systems, their system, when there was harm done to a child or the death of a child. Okay. Just this last summer, pastor called me and he said, a 17-year-old boy is dating a 15-year-old girl in our church and he murdered her. And I said, well, you've got a problem because you can't do ministry to both families. But you're going to have to find that somehow somebody does some ministry for these people. I was in Oklahoma City, and someone took me to where the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building had been. And the pastor at the Baptist church, just 2 blocks away, said, we lost some members, but we really went crazy in our place when 2 months later, a father and a mother and 4 children were in an automobile accident. The mother and the father lived, but the 4 children were killed. Okay? It's something about we should be able to protect the young. And when life is so random and haphazard, we just feel out of control. And anxiety rises. Next, anything that has to do with building space, territory, construction. We're very emotional about space. I fly a lot. An airline provides 2 seats, but only 1 armrest. To which seat does it belong? I sometimes think if I get there first, I can have squatter's rights, but that's not always true, okay? We get very, very emotional about those settings. Next, lay leadership style. In some places, lay leaders are slothful, apathetic, hands off, and in other places, they're micromanagers and they got their finger in the emotional pie all the time, and anything in between. Next, I just call it the change process. People today are going to workshops, they're reading books, and they know that church life has to change. The context in which the church finds itself has changed, and therefore the church has to change. But what most people don't know is how do you do the change process? Okay? Some people simply do it too fast. Rather than realizing that change occurs as a process and over time. I remember something Woody Allen once said. He said, I've taken a speed reading course, and I read War and Peace in 20 minutes. It's about Russia. You don't really get to too much or in terms of depth or breadth when it's that fast. And we don't know how to plan for it, do it properly, and also to deal with the resistance when there is change. Next, staff conflict, staff resignations. These always create anxiety in a system, no matter who the person is or how many people are involved. Next, a major trauma or a major transition. Major trauma would include pastor is murdered, pastor is a murderer, pastor commits suicide, church burns down, sexual misconduct, all of those I've been a part of. Major transition. Pastor who founded the church leaves. Some pastor who's been very prominent retires. Staff, I have six staff people, leave very quickly. These are all major transitions and create some anxiety. Well, anyway, those are the major ones. The other ones, if you're interested, are in the book. But regardless, when these things occur, a system should be anxious. Now, this is what I've learned. This is not my first rodeo. What will happen here will be no different from what has happened in 199 other churches. When the anxiety becomes intense, and even if it becomes protracted, that in itself will not do the system in. It all depends on how you deal with the anxiety. If you're more reactive, there's going to be greater loss. It's going to take longer to heal. If there's more response, intentionality, calm reflectiveness, there's going to be less time to get out of the situation, and there's going to be greater healing. That's all I can tell you very basically. Now, I don't have any magic to heal the situation. Okay? If I had it, I'd put it in a bottle and send it to you. In fact, I remember a pastor's wife in therapy. It was the only gift I ever accepted from somebody, but it was just such a good visual aid. She made me a velvet wand, and on it she stitched, "This does not work." I don't have magic. I know this, though. How you move from where you are now to a better place will be guaranteed by your maturity and your motivation, what you want to do with it. Okay. I will work with you to do the best process possible to get there. But I do this knowing that you know the congregation far better than I do. You are the experts. You pool the intellect and the experience of this group, and it far surpasses anything that I have to offer. Now, I will give you some suggestions and some ideas, and I'll make some observations, and I'll be sure to raise some very pertinent questions to help you move towards that goal. Okay? But I also know it's easier to get into something than to get out of it. Okay? And sometimes we get into something, we want to know how in the world that even happened. But this is my basic purpose for this process, that you learn something. And out of that learning, you change something. Because if you don't, you're going to waste your suffering. And there's a good chance you'll repeat the behavior again. No emotional system changes unless people in the system change how they function with each other. Okay? That'd be true of your marriage, your workplace, as well as your congregation. Until people function in different ways with one another, the old patterns will continue. And that's one thing we've learned in emotional systems, that once patterns of behavior develop, people resist change. Even if it's painful, even if it's not getting what you want, even if it may be an improvement, some other behavior, it's familiar. A friend of mine's a neuroscientist, and he really believes that neurologically, we would prefer familiarity to happiness. We like to know things. And part of that is neurological, by the way, because all new information does go through the right lobe. And once it becomes known, it's part of the left lobe. We know that from brain imaging. So if you would do brain imaging of a novice violinist, all of the activity is in the right brain. When you do brain imaging of a professional violinist, all of the activity is in the left brain. So one part of the brain is that which is not familiar and novel, and the other part of the brain is that which is known and familiar. But here's something you've got to remember. The right brain is also the location of all the negative emotions. So when something is uncertain, unknown, novel, it can easily arouse anxiety, anger, disgust. Whereas when we know things and things are familiar, it's more pleasurable and joyful. That's neurologically based. And that's probably why we give more power to the past than we do to the future. Because the past is known. But you are now here to learn from this experience to create a better future for yourself. And that's extremely important. Whether or not you get there depends on, are we going to be more reactive to what has happened? Or are we going to find ourselves more in a responsive way? Now, you can spend all your time you want to lay blame. It's not going to help. Okay? But what did happen, and can we learn something from that so it makes our life better for the future? Now, I also want to talk about another concept, and that's differentiation. Murray Bowen used the phrase self-differentiation. He borrowed the term differentiation from biology. In biology, when a cell matures, it is said to have differentiated. It becomes a muscle cell, a liver cell, a heart cell. A stem cell is an immature cell, or what one biologist said, an uncommitted cell. So differentiation is really a phrase for maturity. So when Bowen used the term differentiation of self, he was saying, this is what a mature person looks like. This is what a mature person does in terms of their functioning. And he said, there's always two forces, two needs that we have to deal with in life, and that is to be a self, and at the same time to be a self that's connected to others. And how we negotiate these two needs determines our level of maturity. Now, the problem will become that sometimes we are afraid of standing on our own two feet. Loneliness is not the place we really want to be in our life. Therefore, when we have that fear, that anxiety about being alone, the tendency is to get too close to people. And that is called emotional fusion. In emotional fusion, you don't know where one person begins and ends and the other person begins and ends. Okay? We know in an addictive family, you've got an abuser and you've got an enabler. That's a system. All right? They're emotionally fused. A romantic love is a form of emotional fusion. Two people fall in love. It's craziness. It's blindness. It's illusion. That's why when I did premarital counseling, I always reminded myself, I'm dealing with two psychotics. My brother remarried a number of years ago, and he married an Episcopal priest, and they asked me to preach at the service, and I started the sermon by saying, when two people marry, they become one. What we don't know is which one. Okay. Because we often confuse fusion with sameness. If we can be the same, we can be close. But in real mature interaction, you can be who you are and I can be who I am, and it's not threatening to either one of us. That's a high level of maturity, being able to deal with that kind of difference. Because difference is one of the things that will arouse the amygdala. Because something different could harm me, could eliminate me, and it could activate my amygdala. Now, the other problem is, on the other side, I could be afraid of getting close to people because if I do, I get hurt. And out of a lot of my relationships, I've had wounds. So therefore, I'll keep you at arm's length. And I will be emotionally cut off from you. But here's the problem. When you emotionally cut off from somebody else, the anxiety from that relationship doesn't disappear. It goes underground. And it gets played out in another relationship. And you're not even knowing anything about it. So the little truism goes this way. Any anxiety not resolved in one relationship gets played out in another relationship. Okay? And it's kind of interesting because the people we usually play out that unresolved issue is with a person who's in one of two functioning positions, either the most responsible or the most vulnerable. That's just what happens in emotional systems. So emotional cutoff is a problem because I don't stay connected. That's an immature way of living. How do we balance these two forces? And all of us have to deal with that at some level or other. So when I'm a better differentiated self and I'm more mature, I use I statements. You know, you're always in control when you say I. I feel, I want, I hope, I believe. The minute you begin saying you or they, you're out of control. Rather than defining your own self, you're trying to define the other people. And a better differentiated person will take I positions. I will do this. I will not do this. Even though the position I take may arouse the ire and the rancor of other people, I believe this is the appropriate position. Because you see, what Bowen was trying to get at is, as human beings, we can operate above the bees and the wasps. Okay? Because we can choose our behaviors. We don't have to have our behavior based simply in instinct. Okay? And that's what a well-differentiated person can do. Make choices based on their convictions, their values, and their beliefs. Third, the other important thing about being a differentiated person is you have a pretty good idea where you're going with your behavior, where you're going with your life, where you're going with who you are. The other morning, my wife and I were sitting down. We like to have little chats in the morning when we drink our coffee. And she says, I have one of the best design classes I've had in a long time. And I said, well, what makes a class best or mediocre or less than desirable? She says, well, the best classes are when the students have a direction and they know where they want to go. So in my class, I've got somebody who wants to design landscape. I have somebody who wants to design furniture. I have somebody who wants to design automobiles. And not only do they have a goal, but they lift up all of the others in the class. And I thought, isn't that also very typical of good, mature systems? When people have a good sense of where they're going, where they're at, it really mobilizes people's energy and people are operating at a higher level. That's real important when you're differentiated. Now, I know by doing this process, I'm going to be sabotaged. It's happened every other time I've done it. I've been sabotaged. I used to be upset when I used to do this early on when I got sabotaged. But now I realize I get sabotaged because I'm doing a good process. And there are going to be some people out there who aren't as mature, and they will be realizing they're losing control or they're not getting what they want. So that at last resort, what they have to do is sabotage me. It's amazing. Congregations hire me to listen to what's going on. I crystallize what it is, and I present it, and they show a mirror, and then they get mad at me. But I know the old statement, you know, when you don't like the message, you shoot the messenger. Yeah. But somebody once told me, Winston Churchill said, nothing in life is more exhilarating than to be shot at and missed. So go ahead. I'm not here to represent any one side or the other, okay? I'm here to listen to you and present to you what I hear from different perspectives. And people had different experiences, okay? And there's been a slice down the middle. Now, the point is, what are you going to do about this? Where are you going to go from here? What can you learn from this particular experience? Okay? And not everybody's going to get out of this process what they wanted. I know that. Okay? Nor will this process keep people from leaving or withholding money or anything like that. Okay? But I've also learned this, that even in those places where a person leaves and is highly adored and highly appreciated and respected, that in most places, the real key is the community, not any one person. That's what really is at the end of it. Okay? So we're interested in how can this community be a community that provides services and hope and changes for the world. Now, I realize that change is very, very difficult. I spoke at the National Cathedral a year ago for the convention of the Episcopal Diocese. And I started my presentation with this story. A man is sitting on a bench watching two workmen. And he's befuddled, watching them work. And then he becomes amused. Because one man takes a shovel, digs a hole about 2 feet deep, pauses, and then the other workman takes his shovel, takes the dirt that has just been removed, and puts it back in the hole. So he went over to the two workmen. He says, "What in the world are you doing?" And one workman said, "We're planting trees. I dig the hole. Charlie puts the plant in the hole, and Chester here covers it up. Charlie's out sick today." This is the story of what we call homeostasis. My other favorite one is the British. They established a civil service job. A man was to go to the hills of Dover and look for Napoleon in 1803. And if Napoleon were spotted, he was to ring a bell. The job was abolished in 1946. Because we know that emotional systems like stability, coherence, like to run pretty smoothly. Okay? And that's what we call homeostasis. And as soon as this homeostasis of a system is upset, there is reactivity all over the place. And some biologists call it the persistence of form. The system will go back to its old way. Okay? That's why I think sometimes crises are very beneficial for all of us. Because don't go back to the old way unless you want to waste your suffering. What can we do that's new that helps us become a more viable and healthy system? All right, those are some of the main principles of the theory behind which I will be operating with. So, first of all, before my conclusion, are there any questions? Anybody have any questions? In the back, yes, sir. Yes. I'm going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Okay? Yes. Well, let me then conclude with another feature of the brain. The left prefrontal cortex is that part of the brain that houses our humanity. If we did not have a fully functioning left prefrontal cortex, our behavior would pretty much be animalistic. This part of the brain gives us five capacities which no other species has fully developed. Number one, because I have a left prefrontal cortex, I can step back from my experience and observe and look and see what happened. Okay? And that's why we often say to ourselves, we got to let the dust settle. We have to let things cool down. Because when things are all in an uproar to begin with, we can't see real clearly. But we have the capacity to step back and look. You don't find two dogs on the curb discussing the meaning of a dog's life. Because they don't have a capacity to step back from their instincts. Secondly, this part of the brain also helps me to see you as an individual. You're separate from me. You have your own needs, your own rights, and I need to respect that. Okay? That comes from the left prefrontal cortex. Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa once said, "Have you ever seen someone throw a bone to a pack of dogs?" And one dog said to the other dog, "After you." The dog has no ability to choose. It's bound by instinct. You and I can make choices in our behavior. Thirdly, this is where we do our imagination, our thinking, our reasoning. Okay? The more anxious we are, by the way, the less the left prefrontal cortex is available to us. Okay? Anxiety diminishes learning. Fourth, this is the part of the brain that can put the brakes on the amygdala. Okay? Don't say that. Don't do that. It gives us some ability to have control. We call it self-regulation. Walter Mischel did an experiment a number of years ago. And I don't know why we don't pay more attention to it. They put some 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds at a table. And before every child, they put a white marshmallow. And hidden in the ceilings and in the walls are television cameras. And they say to the children, don't eat the marshmallow, because if you don't, you'll get a second marshmallow when I come back in 2 minutes. So the experimenter leaves the room. And then you watch the children. Some eat that marshmallow within 5 seconds. Some look to see what the other's doing. Okay? 2/3 ate the marshmallow before the experimenter came back. 1/3 didn't. In fact, the experimenter stayed out 15 minutes. Okay. Then they did a longitudinal study of the children. The children that lacked self-regulation had poor academic achievements, more behavioral problems and difficulties in life compared to those who are able to self-regulate. I think there's a tremendous message there. Okay? How important it is to be a mature person and have some capacity for self-regulation. And of course, you know, most unself-regulated people just send tons of emails. Now, when I have the ability to be self-regulating, I can put the brakes on the amygdala. That's not really going to be helpful. And then finally, the fifth thing the left prefrontal cortex allows us to do is to have a future. Every other part of the brain deals with the present or the past. This part of the brain helps us to plan, see possibilities, set up scenarios, hope. Okay? Incredibly powerful. And this part of the brain is most influenced by the environment. It can be influenced by the environment up to the age of 20 or 25. Personally, I've always wondered why people in the church aren't greater advocates for children. Because from 0 to 3, 250,000 neurons a day are being developed. It's an incredible time for learning. But if you grow up in an environment that's neglectful, violent, abusive, what neurons get struck? Okay, don't trust anybody. Fight fire with fire. As opposed to being in a welcoming, caring, loving environment, other neurons are fired, you know? And why we don't become greater advocates for prenatal care, postnatal care, nutrition, health insurance for small children, I don't understand that. Because if it's not good in the early time, it ain't going to be better in the future time. That's just a little extra comment for myself. Now the process. You will have in hand or receive one, a response sheet. There's 4 different ones. It doesn't matter which one you get. I just did 4 because I found I get better responses when I have 4 different ones. And I don't want any names. I just like you to fill that sheet out. If there's a question you don't understand, don't fill it out. If there's a question you don't think is important, don't fill it out. If there's one question you want to spend a lot of time on, spend time on that, okay? The more specific and succinct you can be, the more helpful it is to me. All right? We'll have you fill these out in a few minutes. Then we'll take a break. And then we'll come back and do a section called Tell It to Peter. And you will be welcome to come to the microphones. And I will give you the guidelines that we will be using. And if you want to modify them, we'll have opportunity to modify them. And then we will have 2 recorders who will write down your responses. And we'll have a timekeeper because there'll be a time limit as part of the guidelines. So I will then take the information I've received from interviews yesterday, plus I've already received about 20 or 25 emails. These response sheets, plus the notes from this morning's session. And I will come back. I believe we have it set for April 4th, isn't it? April 4th. and I will give what I call the action report. And I call it the action report because I used to call it the report, but people always thought of a report card. Who was good, who was bad, who was right, who was wrong. That's not what it's about. It's about taking some action. And I will outline for you 3 to 5 major issues that I heard. I will raise questions. I will make observations. Okay. I will give it publicly. You will have a copy of it. If you want to ask questions, you want to contest it, you want to add something to it, you'll have that opportunity when I give the action report. After giving the report, I will then meet with 16 people on the action planning team. And we will take the items from the report and begin to address them. What can we do to deal with these issues? Then the action planning team will take their results and share them with you in focus groups. And you can say, yay, nay, or here's some other ideas that I have that I think would be helpful. After the focus groups are completed, the action planning team will write a final report and present it to the board. I will come back at that point and meet with the action planning team and the board to set up a structure for how these might get implemented and who will be responsible for them, and to be sure that they're communicated to you, the congregation, so that you are aware of that something is happening. Okay? That's the process. Any questions on that? Yes. I could provide a bibliography for you, yes, if you'd like, yes. I'll give it to the office and you can ask for that there, okay? My 2 books will be on there for sure. Anybody else? Any other questions? Okay, if you will fill out this sheet, please don't fold it. Just put it down. Nobody will peek at you. Let's put them on the piano when you're done, okay? And we will come back together here in 15 minutes, all right?